I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to John Scott, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Davis. We're discussing his recent book, Rousseau's God, Theology, Religion, and the Natural Goodness of Man, from the University of Chicago Press. Scott's research focuses on the history of political thought, particularly the work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He is the author of several books and articles on Rousseau and other modern thinkers. Well, first of all, John Scott, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great to have you back for another book on Rousseau, another installment. Rousseau is I have a bust of Rousseau on the podcast image, so this is always I feel like returning to the origins here. So it's great to talk about your book, John, which I very much enjoyed, on Rousseau's view of religion and theology. It's quite wide ranging across Rousseau's corpus, and quite well done. Can I ask you, first of all, just to say a little bit about what motivated you to write the book in the first place?
Well, the editors at Chicago asked me to take out something I originally had in the acknowledgments. So I'll tell you what was originally in the acknowledgments. Namely, somewhat embarrassingly, this is basically my senior honors thesis when I was in college. I was at Dartmouth working with Roger Masters, who you may have seen recently passed away. He suggested I do a senior honors thesis, and I didn't really know what that was about or what I was doing. And I said, well, I really don't know what I want to do. And I said, but I know what I don't want to do. And he said, what? And I said, Rousseau. So he suggested I do it on Rousseau. If I have enough sort of antipathy, then I have the energy to do it through. And the thing that really kind of perplexed me was religion in Rousseau's thought. It was not a subject I'd given much thought to, being from a very secular background. So I felt this kind of wrestle. Why is Rousseau interested in religion? Why does it seem so important to him in various contexts? Then I went to graduate school. I resisted the impulse to work on Rousseau, and instead I wrote on Rousseau and religion. So embarrassingly, this has been going on for decades now. And I finally saw clearly, I thought, and I hope at least, how to do that book. And so here's the book.
Excellent. Okay. So there's quite a bit to talk to your therapist, I guess, about your wrestling with Rousseau in the future. Good. That's great. So maybe you could get us started. I mean, this is a very, it's a kind of complicated argument that you have about Rousseau on religion, but it's complicated in the sense that, like, the argument itself is complicated about truth and utility, but it's also complicated in the sense that you sort of walk us through the corpus. So I thought we could proceed in terms of, kind of walking through some of the texts that you discuss, but if you could maybe just first of all talk about, kind of give us an overall statement of the argument.
All right. In addition to seeing how important the themes of, or the issues of theology and religion were to Rousseau, and how often he returned to them in his works in different contexts and different with different emphases, what also struck me, so I wanted to investigate that, right? But as I thought, and this is really the revelation, I suppose, that led to the book, was I thought, well, that's kind of a topic. That's not really an argument. So what's my argument? And I thought about it long and hard. And what I came to is this, there's a tension between, on the one hand, Rousseau's philosophy, and on the other hand, what he has to say about theology and religion. And what I mean by that is, by his philosophy, is the doctrine of the natural goodness of man and his corruption in society. And there's a tension, I think, between that and what he has to say about theology and religion. Namely, that, to put it bluntly, natural man does not need religion. natural man is naturally good. He's naturally self-sufficient. He's happy. And insofar as, say, a meal can be educated on the pattern of natural man, even if he's not a stupid animal in the pure state of nature, the question that arose to me is, does a meal need religion? Or is he sufficiently happy, virtuous, et cetera, on his own terms without needing religion or theological doctrine and so on? That question then led me to why does Rousseau give a separate section in A Meal to the profession of faith, the Savoyard Vicar, where you find the religious, theological and religious teachings? I said, well, does A Meal need that? And my answer is no. So, well, who does need it then? Well, everyone else, basically. So, in other words, the tension I see between Rousseau's philosophy on the one hand and his treatment of theology and religion has more to do with the utility of religion for various reasons, for citizens, for individuals who are corrupted in society, et cetera, rather than its truth value. So, again, I see a tension between the philosophy and the theology that revolves around the question of truth and utility.
Right. In this way, Rousseau is somewhat similar to Machiavelli in the sense that what he's primarily interested in, right, is the sort of social and political utility of religion, I suppose you could say.
Yes.
But what distinguishes him, I mean, this is thing about your argument, I take it, is the way in which it seems like religion is imperiled, both from, say, on the one hand, the Enlightenment, the materialistic Enlightenment of Voltaire. We'll talk about him in a bit, but, you know, the sort of growing rational self-awareness of humanity in the Enlightenment period, but also sort of imperiled through a closer attention to the beginnings of humanity, not the current. So religion is really it has some usefulness, but it seems like very fragile in the sense of how it can be sustained, I suppose. Is that a fair summary?
I think that's fair, and I would phrase it, maybe add the following. Yes, Rousseau sees religion as being under threat by the Enlightenment, again, Voltaire and that group, and he thinks it would be a disaster to threaten religion per se, because people need it. They need it to be virtuous. They need it to be happy. They need it for consolation. Maybe we need it for political reasons as well. So he thinks that secularization is a mistake. On the other hand, he joins Voltaire and the philosophe in critiquing the existing religion, such as Christianity, particularly in its Catholic form, but Christianity as it's come down as established religions. He thinks they're also corrupting of people. So he's got to steer a kind of middle course. On the one hand, he wants to promote salutary religious beliefs on the one hand, but on the other hand, he wants to steer clear of the kinds of religious beliefs, practices that he thinks are equally corrupting.
Great. Yeah. So let's talk about some of the texts to kind of flesh the argument out a little bit. You start in the first chapter by talking about the first discourse appropriately to, I guess, thematize this distinction between truth and utility as the kind of two criteria or two ways to assess theology and religion. You could start describe how the first discourse kind of brings out these two criteria.
Right. Let me actually begin with another writing in that chapter, which is his defense of Émile in the letter to Beaumont. So it's not me who's imposing the truth versus utility criteria on assessing religions. It's Rousseau. He himself says religion should be considered from two points of view, truth and utility, and the two should not be presumed to go together. So you might have useful religions that aren't true, or true religions that aren't useful, and so on. But then what I saw, what I wanted to argue was this distinction isn't unique to his discussion of religion in the letter to Beaumont or his discussion about religion, period. Rather, it's a theme that runs throughout his thought, beginning with the first discourse, Discourse on Sciences and the Arts. Namely, as captured by his putative argument in the work, the advancement of the sciences and arts has tended to corrupt morals. So there's something about truth, the advancement of sciences and arts, that is at odds with popular morality, with popular views, including political and religious views. And this tension leads Rousseau into a very difficult position because he wants to promote truth as he understands it on the one hand, but he wants to do it in such a way as it's not going to be corrupting of morals. So this leads to sort of the paradoxical character of his thought and the way that he writes about these issues throughout. So I wanted to argue that this distinction between truth and utility runs throughout his work and animates the way that he approaches these issues.
Yeah, that's good. One of the things you say in this chapter, which kind of struck me, was the that you're not particularly interested in what Rousseau actually believes about religion. You know, even though Rousseau kind of at some point sort of insists that he's a Christian of a certain kind. Maybe you could just kind of explain what you mean by that. Is it because you're focused on the kind of, or you think that Rousseau's primary interest with regard to religion is utility, so he's not particularly interested himself in sort of offering what he takes to be the truth about religion?
Well, I think in terms of religion, he's really an epistemological modesty is how he approaches this. He doesn't really think we can know, or if what we might know through natural religion, for example, through reasoning about the world, it's still minimal, let's say. So there's that question. But I think one thing that I think distinguishes my book and my approach from most of what's been written on Rousseau and religion previously is other scholars have tended to assume that Rousseau is sincere in what he writes under his own name. You know, I'm a Christian, without investigating, well, what does he really mean by saying that he's a Christian? What's the context in which he says it, and so on? And likewise, what Rousseau has others say in his works, notably the Savoyard Vicar. The assumption by most of these authors is Rousseau's own beliefs are what he's expressing in these works. Again, most particularly in the Profession of Faith. I think that that is both wrongheaded and ultimately futile. To begin with, futile, we don't know what he actually thought. I mean, it's pretty much that simple. What Rousseau himself may have believed is not really known to us. And secondly, when you pay attention to, let's call it, the more literary aspects of how he, or rhetorical aspects of how he approaches these subjects, you're put on alert that there's a distance of some degree between what he writes and what he may believe. The most obvious example being putting the religious teaching and the Profession of Faith into someone else's mind. So other interpreters have assumed that the Savoyard Vicar is Rousseau's mouthpiece, or he's speaking for Rousseau in some fashion. But I think if you pay attention to the narrative aspects, which I'm sure we'll get to, you see that there's actually a different sort of purpose that Rousseau has in putting it in the vicar's mouth, for example. So again, as you said, I'm not particularly interested in what Rousseau's own personal religious views are, because I don't think we can know them. And I don't think that it's actually important. What I'm interested in is, what is he trying to do with these subjects in his written works?
Just to push one more thing on that, on this, is, but we can be confident in concluding, though, that he is a theist of some sort, right? Or maybe is it your view that we really just don't even know whether he is a theist or atheist, or maybe some sort of agnostic? The reason I ask is because it seems like Rousseau at least has some kind of commitment, although we can get to this more in the Savoyard Vicar section, some kind of commitment to the kind of redeeming the sort of spiritualism of human beings in some way, that resisting the kind of materialistic tendency of the modern Enlightenment. Though maybe that itself could, I suppose one could say, is just could be just a kind of useful useful statement, and maybe perhaps not true. But I mean, what's your view on that? I mean, is he a theist of some sort? We just don't know what type, or we just don't know, period.
I think we don't know, period. I would say that the majority view among scholars has been that he's some sort of theist. Perhaps a fairly minimalist theist, as you know, clockmaker god type theist. We reason from the order of the world that there was an orderer, what's called that, the divinity. I think that's the majority of view of what Rousseau probably believes, but it really rests so heavily on the profession of faith as the most extensive statement of something like that. Rousseau himself, in his own name, so to speak, always keeping in mind that he has always got an audience and a rhetorical purpose here. Rousseau in his own name says, for example, nature, the order of nature does not speak to all men equally. He even says that in defending the profession of faith to the Archbishop. So Vollmar, for example, and Julie, nature doesn't speak to him in its order. Vollmar is an atheist. Is Rousseau an atheist? I don't know. There's good reason to think that he is a sort of Epicurean materialist of a sort. But I don't think, again, we need to know that or even posit a view on that and still be reading what he wrote and asking ourselves, what's the content of what he wrote and what's the authorial purpose or audience or effect that he means it to have. So that was what interested me.
We were talking just before about the reveries, and even in the reveries where there's some reflection too on religion and the consolations of the afterlife and so forth, it's so difficult to kind of suss out whether or not those are kind of sincere beliefs, and he seems to kind of overturn them at certain points too. So yeah, that's difficult. So I mean, I can see that, you know, the sort of focus on the utility of religion is a useful analytic focus. So let's talk about the second discourse and the letter to Voltaire, which you turn to next, because you turn to it as a discussion of theodicy, that is a justification of God's design against, despite the evil that we see around us, the kind of problem of evil question, and the way in which, you know, the second discourse can provide some kind of redemption to the human evils that we cause. At least that's one typical reading of this. And these issues, of course, come out much more clearly in the letter to Voltaire, where the exchange is about the Lisbon earthquake and the problem of evil. So maybe I can start with the second discourse, because you take issue with some thinkers who I sort of associate with the kind of Kantian tradition of reading Rousseau, which is kind of envisions Rousseau's second discourse as a kind of teleological theodicy, that is, you know, kind of redemption at the end of history, where human beings kind of through the tools that we develop through the fall, we can kind of redeem ourselves. But for you, the redemption of evil comes kind of at the beginning with the natural goodness of human beings. Maybe you could develop that, you know, that interpretation.
No, right. I mean, I think you stated it quite well. And so that chapter on the second discourse is a much revised version of the very first article I ever published, Theodicy of the Second Discourse. And in fact, I take issue with myself. When I first published that, I really thought of it as much more of a theological argument on Rousseau's part. And there were certain arguments that Rousseau made in there, in the Second Discourse, that I never felt comfortable with fitting with my interpretation of it. But since I believe in utility and not truth, I published it and moved on. But upon revisiting it, I thought, for example, his language in the Second Discourse about providence, which only happens once in the text of the Second Discourse, is actually much cagier than I initially thought. I mean, you know, when I was writing it many years ago, that article, that chapter in my dissertation originally, I saw the word providence. I'm like, aha, you know, providence, here we have theology. But again, I never quite felt comfortable with my interpretation. So in revising it for this purpose, what I really wanted to emphasize was it's not so much a theodicy as a physiodicy, the Second Discourse. In other words, a justification of nature, not of God. And so there's where I return to the natural goodness of man in the beginning, so to speak, in Rousseau's portrait of natural man in the pure state of nature, as saying the evil comes not from ourselves, as natural beings, but rather the evil comes from our going in society. So in other words, taking Rousseau's statement of the doctrine that unifies his works, namely, man is naturally good and he's corrupted in society, taking that as my lodestar for interpreting the Second Discourse. So it's a justification of nature in the sense that it's not from nature the evil comes, but rather an accident of history of humans going into society. So that was the main thrust of what I wanted to emphasize in that argument. And in a certain sense, it addresses the theological problem, the problem of evil, but in a novel way. Now on that subject, I agree with Kessler and a number of Kantian interpreters that Rousseau has found a novel solution to the problem of evil. But like you said, I find that to be in the beginning, in this picture of nature, as opposed to the end, so to speak, of history resolving these things in a way that Kant sees Rousseau doing.
Yeah, and I mean, maybe you could bring in the letter to Voltaire, because I found this, you know, fascinating as a way of reading that text, where the letter to Voltaire, essentially you see it as offering two different kinds of, you know, solutions to the problem of evil, as it were, two different teachings. One, a teaching of physiodicy, there is the natural goodness of man, although I'm curious exactly what kind of consolation that provides to social man, but you can take that up. But then the second part of the letter to Voltaire, where really Rousseau does take up a lot of this language about providence much more clearly, you read it as along these lines of a kind of utility. That, you know, there's a certain utility to buying that story about providence for social man.
Yes, and when I wrote that, when I was reading the letter to Voltaire many years ago, again, what led me in a direction of the argument I made was less a let's call it philosophical or theoretical concern with that letter than it was a literary one. What I started noticing in just simply the Rousseau's writing in the letter to Voltaire, and just as a note, it's not really a letter. I mean, it is a letter that he sends Voltaire, but he very carefully drafted it. We have several drafts, versions of it. So he clearly had in mind publication. So it's a letter in name only, so to speak. But what I noticed in reading it was echoes, stylistic or wording echoes in the letter itself. Him using the same phrase in different places in the letter. And what I came to realize, I hope I showed it, but what I at least thought I realized, is that Rousseau's letter to Voltaire actually contains parallel treatments of providence and the issues related to providence. In one part of the letter, I'll call it natural providence. And then the second half of the letter is divine providence. So it's in the second half of the letter where he turns to more traditional notions of questions of theodicy, questions of providence, and so on and so forth. But he puts them forward not only as doubtful, but he actually admits that the reason that he, for example, hopes for an afterlife is because of the miseries of this life. And he presents it as a hope, as being motivated by hope. He does not present it as being true. He presents the views of God, the afterlife, etc., as consolation for himself and, you know, by extension for others. So I think it's a much more complex writing than it appears at first, or so I argue at least.
Yeah, so I guess I'm, that's good. I mean, I'm curious in terms of the natural goodness piece of the theological story, in part because I think if I understand your view and the sort of contrary, you know, Kantian view, I'm more on the, maybe unsurprisingly, since I work on the Germans, more of a a Kantian reader. I mean, maybe I ask the question in this way. There seems to be a kind of division in the literature, thinking about Rousseau, where, you know, there's kind of two different ways you can think about, you know, Rousseau's view of nature, as it were. That is, that there's a kind of way to think about nature as something unified and whole, and hence sort of justifiable and good, as on your view. But then there's the view that, you know, say, like, you know, I think about in Jonathan Marks has written about this, and the what's his book called again? The
Perfection. Something about
Perfection, the disharmony. Yeah. So there's like a disharmony in nature. And I've come to be kind of persuaded by his view against yours. So you could take this as an opportunity to, I guess, convince me why I shouldn't think in this way. But, you know, I mean, so for example, one thing that is quite striking about nature, human nature, as Rousseau presents it, say in the second discourse, is that, right, we have these physical features, physical characteristics that sort of put us into harmony with the rest of nature, but we have these metaphysical, as he calls them, characteristics in nature, above all freedom and perfectibility, that when developed seem to actually, you know, pit us against our natural inclinations. And even if it's a kind of, you know, this perfectibility and freedom are very undeveloped, and so don't cause problems, they're there. And I mean, nature put them there in a certain form, and it has there's a kind of disharmony that's there at the heart of it. So yeah, I mean, you have a chapter on, you know, a section of the chapter on freedom and perfectibility, I think maybe in part to kind of address this kind of concern. So, but maybe you could kind of talk through that.
No, that is why they're there. I agree with Jonathan, actually. So I'm actually a disharmony guy, despite the fact I look like a harmony guy. And I think when I've, that's another case in which I really felt like I needed 4 decades to think it through, because I didn't know how to reconcile those two. I think, for just as an example, when Rousseau says that the faculties that we have in potential because of perfectibility don't develop in the state of nature or pure state of nature and need not have ever developed, that's just plain wrong as a claim about what he actually writes. So if you're looking more carefully, you see the operation of perfectibility within the pure state of nature, the invention of tools and so on. And the argument seems really to be, if you take it as sort of an historical narrative, the argument really seems to be, well, yes, there can be perfectibility on the level of the individual, or maybe even small groups like the family, but it doesn't spread, so to speak, to the whole of mankind in a way that transforms our condition. So I would say that'd be a more accurate statement. of what he actually argues, again, taking his sort of historical narrative. And in that sense, Jonathan's discussion of the perfection, disharmonies already there. Yeah, they're there too. So I agree with him on that. So that made me have to rethink, well, what is this pure state of nature, the first part of the second discourse, really doing? And I guess I moved over the years from viewing it as historical or quasi-historical and viewing it as, in a way, more like, to appeal to your Kantian self, a regulative idea. It's a state that, given human nature, as Rousseau understands it, could exist by nature, and that orderliness, wholeness, goodness of natural man is, so to speak, an asymptotic possibility rather than an actual condition. It might have been a condition in some way, but in a way, what's more important is what it reveals to us about, once we start sliding down the path of history, about the evils that we experience are not there at the quote unquote beginning, and that he's more interested in explaining the origin of evil than he is in a certain sense, than he is in positing the natural goodness as an actual condition. That's what I would, I hope at least I argued.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, I guess I still am left with a question. So why does nature give us freedom then? Freedom and perfectibility. I mean, what kind of function does that serve? I mean, if the idea is just to sort of asymptotically, I mean, it's effectively, right, the asymptote is headed in the direction of rolling back any kind of perfectibility, or at least in its social form, right? And you lose all the virtues and vices that are associated with perfectibility, which he ties it to, right? So, you know, I mean, in part, a lot of this is what I often think. I mean, it even comes up in the Emile, the discussion of virtue and being sort of deserving of one's happiness. You know, that's something that's lost in the, you know, in the pure state of nature. So it almost seems like the pure state of nature is, it has that sense of wholeness and happiness, but for Rousseau, wholeness and happiness isn't the full telos of human beings and given what nature's given to us.
Oh, I agree with that. And I think people tend to fall for Rousseau's rhetoric about perfectibility being the source of all these evils. He actually says our virtues and our vices. It's not just vices. So, and natural man is not, you know, recognizably human. He's not recognizably free in any meaningful sense of the term, for example. Certainly not virtuous at all. I would say one of the ways you phrase is, well, why did nature give it to us? That's making nature purposeful. So that then leads us back to the question, is he a theist? You know, is there a God with a plan who made nature and human nature the way they did? And I'll duck that question and say that this is one of the reasons why I found my original discussion in the article version many years ago to be unsatisfying, is the one mention that he has of providence in the second discourse is when he says it was by a very wise providence that our faculties were given to us in such a way that they only emerged as we needed them. Well, that's pretty perverse given what his argument is. You know, his argument being that once they do emerge, we have new needs and passions and faculties, that this tends to corrupt us. Need not necessarily corrupt us, perhaps, but tends to corrupt us. So by a very wise providence, we are given these faculties that make us miserable. To rephrase that phrase. Well, that's a very strange way of thinking about providence. And so it doesn't seem at all providential. As a matter of fact, it seems to be an indictment of providence. if you think about it that way. So I discussed that in that chapter. Is in what way can you read the discussion of providence in the second discourse? Is it exculpation or justification of providence, which is, you know, his claim? Or is it, in fact, an indictment of providence that we are given these faculties that ultimately make us miserable? Or is it both at the same time, which is my answer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Let's see. Let's talk about the profession of faith. I mean, I need to resist myself because I could get on the second discourse rabbit hole here with you. But I want to get a chance to talk about the profession of faith. Although I guess I have some things to say about that too. You very helpfully read an article that I wrote on Rousseau and the kind of division of humanity. So I think these are discussions that we had around when I was writing this article too. So maybe you can talk about the profession of faith of the Savoyard vicar. You have, you know, the big chunk of the book is about that portion of the Émile, three chapters. The first chapter, you kind of set the stage for it, talking about the dramatic context and whatnot. The second chapter, you talk about the theological view of it. And the third chapter, you talk about the critique of biblical scriptural view. So maybe start by talking about the kind of context for the Savoyard vicar section in the Émile and the some of the dramatic relevant significant dramatic features of it that set it apart.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And as you know, my previous book, Rousseau's Reader, I attended at even greater length to the narrative, dramatic, rhetorical situation of the profession of faith. So I tried to be as brief as possible and still get it in this version here. So let me begin by saying what is characteristic of almost every single interpreter who takes up the profession of faith, with a few exceptions, but very few exceptions, is they don't pay attention to any of the aspects of its placement. Where is it placed in the book? Who's speaking? What do we learn about the characters in this story that he tells, and how that might speak to the content and purpose of the profession of faith? They tend to take the profession of faith as Rousseau's sincere beliefs, for some unknown reason placed in someone else's mouth. They tend to read it as though it's a standalone writing, as opposed to part of Émile. And so I came at it with the more literary view, if I may put it that way, or the rhetorical view, is what's it doing where it is, and why does he present it the way he does? So first of all, just in terms of position, it's, as you know, in book four of Émile, which is the dawn of adolescence, the dawn of the passions, the imagination that are a threat to Émile's happiness, wholeness, virtue, and so on. And so in the main text of Émile, where Émile is being governed by Jean-Jacques, there's a very elaborate, you know, way of making sure that this doesn't go bad. That the passions that he has inflamed don't turn to pride, don't turn to corruption, that the imagination doesn't lead him in bad ways, but somehow it's going to be led in good ways. So there's a careful management of Émile's psyche, let's call it, in book four. That's mainly the topic of book four. Well, about halfway through book four, all of a sudden you get the profession of faith. And it's introduced the reader may be surprised that Émile's not heard of religion yet. Well, yeah, this is unusual for a 14, 15-year-old boy in 18th century France. And Rousseau says, well, rather than telling you myself about religion, I'm going to provide this writing that, you know, somehow fell in my hands, and I only testify to the truth of the facts. He doesn't testify to the truth of the doctrines being presented in there. So I think this, again, when you view the profession in that context, you're led to immediately start wondering, was this, in my view at least, is this intended for a meal? Would this teaching that we're about to get about God, afterlife, and so on be appropriate for a meal? But most importantly, would it be necessary? Jean-Jacques, the governor's management of Emile's psyche, doesn't rely upon religion. It relies upon a carefully crafted environment, a carefully crafted direction of the imagination, and other things. So now into sort of more narrative elements of the profession. Once again, with very few exceptions, maybe two exceptions, interpreters have not looked at the narrative. They jump immediately into the teaching in the profession of faith proper. But why does Rousseau give us this information about the young boy, unnamed, unidentified, who finds himself in a very Rousseau-like position, running away from home, being corrupted, and so on and so forth. And then he encounters this Savoyard vicar who sort of saves him from being corrupt and gives him this theological and religious teaching. They don't, most interpreters don't attend to this sort of, well, what do we learn about the characters in this story? How do they compare to Emile and Jean-Jacques? Well, the basic answer I have is, the young boy is corrupt. He's on or on the verge of corruption. He is not Emile. Emile does not need this teaching to remain whole and happy. Likewise, the Savoyard vicar, we learn, is, I don't know if I want to say corrupt, but let's just say he feels division in his soul for various reasons, including the fact that he's celibate. Or he's supposed to be celibate is actually the answer. He's not celibate. He breaks his vows. So he sees a tension between what nature asks of him, sexually in this case, and what the conventions, in this case being a priest, ask of him. So Savoyard vicar feels division in his soul. So does the young boy, right? Very much unlike Emile, very much unlike the tutor Jean-Jacques. So this led me to say, what if the doctrines of the profession of faith are appropriate for that kind of reader or that kind of audience, someone with a divided soul who needs this kind of religious teaching to be virtuous, happy, for consolation, in ways that Emile, who the precise point of Emile is that he's not going to have a divided soul, that he's going to be whole and happy with some complications coming in the form of Sophie. But it would not be appropriate or necessary for Emile. So in other words, I see the narrative aspects in the way that the profession is positioned in the book, in the dramatic introduction, as giving us clues about Rousseau's audience and the status of the contents of the profession.
So just to connect it with the letter to Voltaire discussion we just had, so is it correct to just summarize that, you know, Emile gets the first lesson of the first teaching of the letter to Voltaire, that is the natural goodness of man sort of lesson. That's the basis for his education. And the boy in the profession of faith receives the second sort of education, that is the edifying sort of providential religious view that's appropriate for a kind of, you know, socially corrupt person.
I wish I'd thought of saying it that way. That's very nice. Thank you. I think that's right. And just to give one example from the letter to Voltaire is Rousseau claims in the first part, what I've argued is the first teaching, the natural goodness of man teaching. He says that existence itself would suffice to justify nature. That's in deep contrast is second teaching, what I've called the, you know, the theological argument about providence, which is where he says we need an afterlife to rectify injustice, to console ourselves, and so on. So on the one hand, nature alone suffices. On the other hand, we need nature doesn't suffice. Well, I think likewise in Emile, nature suffices for Emile. Again, with not without complications, but just as a simple way to put it. Whereas for the Savoyard vicar and his young audience, it does not suffice. It doesn't suffice to explain the division I feel in my soul. It doesn't suffice to justify the evils I see or experience in the world. I need an afterlife to do that. I need something more than nature can give me.
Yeah, that's good. I think one way scholars have thought about the profession of faith, and I guess how I generally tended to think about it before I read your book, was that why? So to answer the question, I guess, that you started with, why does Rousseau put this, you know, profession of faith in the mouth of a vicar? Well, the answer is because he's kind of dodging responsibility. Rousseau, he doesn't want to, you know, these are censorious times. He knows he's going to be heavily punished for, and of course the book did become banned. So it didn't, that strategy didn't sort of work out. But I mean, one way to think about it is that, you know, why is he doing that to protect himself? Because that kind of interpretation, I think, has allowed scholars to just see this as kind of a mouthpiece of Rousseau, but as a kind of simple mechanism in order to kind of, distance himself from it.
Right. No, that is precisely what most scholars who approach this do. They assume that he puts it into someone else's mouth as a precaution. Given the sacrilegious and other elements of the work, and that these are his true views, it's just put in a mouthpiece for those sort of reasons. And as you know, I take that up in discussing it. And first of all, as you yourself noted, if that was his intention, it really didn't work. But let's say that's not satisfying, though. What I find peculiar is, and I discuss this with the defense of the profession of faith in the letter to Beaumont. Beaumont says that the vicar is his mouthpiece, that this is really Rousseau. And Rousseau insists on differentiating himself from the vicar. And by this point, prudence is out. I mean, he's already been condemned, his arrest ordered for him. So he doesn't really have anything to lose by admitting that, that was me. He insists that he's the editor of the writing rather than the author of the writing. He insists on differentiating between the views expressed in the main text in his own authorial voice from those expressed by the Saviour vicar, and so on. So I asked myself, well, why would he do that? Right? Why would he continue to insist upon this, given he has really nothing to lose by admitting it at this point? Moreover, unlike Voltaire, he put his name to the book. And so you didn't have to look around to find Jean-Jacques Rousseau, author of Émile. He could have just written it anonymously or published it separately or something like that. So it seemed to me that that we need to explain his decision to keep insisting that they're not the same. And I think the obvious short version of my answer is because they are separate and different. they're written by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, the author, but that's not the narrative voice. In the work itself, whether the narrative voice in Émile is different than the narrative voice in the Saviour vicar. The audience of Émile, both in the sense of the pupil and the reader, is a different audience than the pupil, although the same audience as the reader, of the profession of faith. So I think, again, drawing on literary theory, which I did more in my previous book, is I'm struck throughout Rousseau's writings, and this would be particularly true, for example, of the Confessions and the Reveries, is there's a difference between Rousseau, the actual human being, the writer, Rousseau, the narrative voice that he has in a given writing, and then Rousseau, the character, oftentimes in his own autobiographies, or in the case of Émile, the character of the tutor. So you have to discriminate among those different things in a way that I think has led other interpreters of profession to collapse them.
Yeah, that's good. So maybe you could say, talk about the first part of this the confession. This is the section where Vicar kind of walks through the theological views that he holds. It's kind of strange because, one way to think about it is, if this is meant to be edifying in the way that you say, it has some pretty sort of complicated, metaphysical speculations. I mean, you could have had it much more on the level of a kind of Platonic mythos, but there's actually, some philosophical meat to this, there are also some ways, and in the article I was mentioned before that you read, I see some similarities between Rousseau's own, theory and the Vicar's discussion of these kind of two principles in the human soul. So there are some similarities, but there are some differences too. So maybe you could sort of walk us through the theology where it kind of coheres with Rousseau's view, where it diverges from it.
That was what really I found the most difficult chapter to write, in part because I agree with you, right? There's sufficient similarity between what Rousseau writes in his own name and what the Vicar writes to invite the assumption that they're the same, or that the one is more of an elaboration. The profession is a more elaborate version of things Rousseau says in his own voice. And that is certainly how it's been read by other scholars. And it was a difficult chapter to write because I didn't want to get in the business of, analytic philosophy, of critiquing, whether the argument made sense, what were the premises, what were the conclusions, the middle term, and so on. I didn't want to get into a sort of philosophical engagement with the profession. I had to a certain point, because I have to explicate, what are the doctrines that the Vicar puts forward and the arguments for it up to a point. But what I was more interested was why does the Vicar make the kind of arguments he does? And where does he diverge from what Rousseau himself writes? So as for the why, what I think is striking about the Vicar, and a lot of people said, well, it's kind of a standard deist type argument. I see order in the universe, therefore there must be an order. Let's call that God. But actually, I think there's a little bit of that in the profession. But what struck me was how little of that there was and how much there was of the Vicar himself. Right, so the Vicar himself, so to speak, projects onto God himself. I feel my will move, therefore I attribute a will to making the universe. And so there's a kind of anthropomorphism or whatever the proper idiosyncratic anthropomorphism, maybe that's the right term, about the Vicar, his arguments themselves and kind of how he proceeds. And so a number of people have said, oh, it looks a lot like Descartes. But it actually doesn't look like Descartes in certain important respects like that. And as far as where he's diverging, just I'll use two examples. There could be others. One example is the Vicar makes a distinction between sensing and judging. Rousseau does too, in his own name. And the philosophers who collapse them, notably Hevatius, but the other materialists who collapse sensation and judgment are making a mistake. The Vicar makes the same argument as Rousseau does, but he attributes it to a sort of a metaphysical dualism, ultimately, in a way that Rousseau, in his own name, in Emile itself, in fact, does not. There's no proclamation about two principles or two metaphysical substances or anything, but that's where the Vicar goes with it. Another example is the Vicar has this famous paean to conscience, conscience, and he connects that conscience to, again, the metaphysical dualism and other related issues in his teaching. Rousseau also talks about conscience in the main text of Emile, in fact, but he does not attach it to any kind of metaphysical thing. Instead, he offers, it would have to be elaborated, but he offers a theory of how conscience and judgment as well are actually psychological developments in us that don't need to appeal to a separate, you know, dualism or something like that. So and ultimately, again, I think what the vicar is trying to do is explain to himself why he feels divided. Answer, because I am divided, right? I have two principles that are at war with one another. Death may reconcile them in some way when my soul escapes the body. The vicar needs that teaching. You don't see that at all in Rousseau's own name, in A Meal, at least. And as you mentioned, where he does talk about it, in, for example, The Reveries, he sort of puts it out there and then takes it back in a complicated way. So, coming back to the question, I was less interested in sort of the philosophical arguments and engaging with the philosophical arguments put forward by the vicar than I was, let's call it, the trend of his argumentation. Why is he making the kinds of arguments he does, as best as I can, at least?
Yeah, and I was trying to think of the kind of audience for this portion of the meal. I mean, the dramatic audience is, of course, you know, that boy who's, I can just imagine that boy listening to this confession. It's got to be a little scary. But thinking in terms of the actual genuine readership of it, of the meal, it seems like this is, I mean, is the audience of this other Enlightenment philosophers that Rousseau's trying to kind of one up a materialistic view, a Helvetius or a Voltaire or somebody like that? You know, that this, you know, I need to offer my own kind of account that Rousseau ultimately does, you know, there's no, you know, this is an edifying view, but it needs to be edifying in a philosophical register, because we live in an Enlightenment age where materialists have some kind of social clout. And so there needs to be a kind of engagement at that level with a kind of philosophical rationalist perspective.
I think that that's right. That's at least one audience. And he's most direct about addressing that audience in the final note he adds to the profession in his own voice. So again, he's portraying himself, presenting himself as the editor of the work. Well, a good editor adds footnotes, and so Rousseau does too. And it's an interesting and I treat this in some places where the note actually undermines what's in the main text of the vicar's argument, or so there are various engagements. And most of the engagements in those notes have to do with materialist philosophers in one way or another. But the very concluding one is where he says that fanaticism is less dangerous than philosophy or atheism, that he is sort of two cheers for fanaticism, religious fanaticism, and no cheers for atheistic philosophy. And his emphasis there is people need to be made virtuous. They need to be made virtuous in this life and have consolation for the lack of virtue they experience in this life. What do you have to offer, atheist philosophers? They don't have anything to offer. And so, yes, he's offering this as a salutary alternative that in some sense meets them on their own ground in a way. So this is not, this is presented as a philosophical, as you said, reasoning on the vicar's part. Whether good philosophical reasoning or not, that's a Voltaire thought it was terrible. He thought, you know, all sorts of logical errors, and he's right about that. But I would say that the main audience of the work, including of the profession, is you and me. You know, we're the readers, and here that we come back to the key claim about truth and utility that we began with. Is Rousseau presents the natural goodness of man as a kind of justification of nature, a justification of our lives. Our lives alone would suffice without anything else. Most people don't buy that. You know, most people say, well, that sounds all very nice and good, this little picture you've given me of natural man. But what about me? You know, I feel miserable. I feel dependent on others. I feel the rich are getting away with things. I see injustice. The doctrine of the natural goodness of man that you so hold to be true. I don't, first of all, I don't think it's true, but it certainly doesn't suffice for me. So there, I think in this sense, if the youth who hears the story is on the verge of corruption, at least, if not corrupt already, and the vicar is divided against himself by his own admission, they're speaking to us who feel these divisions in ourselves and who just can't get the consolation from the natural goodness of man that we need.
Yeah, good. And you know, something you said a minute ago is striking, that that sort of atheistic, materialistic philosophy maybe is not as corrupting as fanaticism. I mean, it makes a good transition to the final part of the confession, as to, it is somewhat surprising, I guess, that Rousseau has this kind of criticism of Christianity in the way he does. I guess because, again, to cast back to the beginning part of our conversation, Rousseau, of course, talks in the first discourse about, the benefits of religion and how Enlightenment scientific reasoning and sort of eroded religious commitment. You might then expect, a kind of commitment to, sort of mythic or, revelation scripture, something like that, to be, affirmed by Rousseau. So why doesn't he? I mean, why this, is it that Christianity just can't be useful in the modern age? But what's his problem there in the second part of that confession?
Well, I think part of the answer is there's Christianity and then there's Christianity, right? There's Christianity as it actually exists, institutionalized in various forms, which Rousseau thinks are pernicious for various reasons. And there's Christianity that he embraces. I'm told that Diderot said of Rousseau, but I can't find the actual quotation. I'm told that he said, Jean-Jacques was a Christian like Jesus was a Jew. So he has poured entirely new wine into the bottles, old bottles here. But I'll take that up in a second. So the title of that chapter was originally Rousseau's Critique of Religion. And then I realized, no, that's not all he does in that part of the profession of faith. He actually also tries to revive a certain kind of understanding of Christianity. So it's both critique of and revival of religion in its own way. So it's more complicated than I really had appreciated before. As far as the critique goes, it's the critique of Christianity, of miracles, of particular scriptures, of revelation in the second part of the work. That's what got him in trouble. The Archbishop of Beaumont probably could care less about the first part of the profession, with the vicar's arguments about nature showing a God and so on and so forth. What he objected to, and other people objected to, was the frontal assault on scriptural religions, not just Christianity, but scriptural religions in the second part of the work. That's, by the way, the part that Voltaire liked. Voltaire said it was all nonsense except about 10 of the best pages ever about the evils of Christianity. So Voltaire liked that part of the work. And so Rousseau takes up, a number of, how could God be just if he only reveals himself to certain people, for example? So the question of theodicy and evil still remains there. But a lot of it is just sort of straightforward. I don't know the original language of the scriptures. How am I supposed to understand it? How did they understand it? Some really standard fare from Spinoza onward, at least. So there's nothing particularly new in his critique of religion that didn't get Spinoza thrown out of the synagogue too. So that is really more of a pastiche, but it's just the baldness with which he did it. There was no hiding here, behind, in Spinoza's case, a pseudonym, for example. But what I found sort of striking again is the revival. So he says, but then I look at the Gospels and, oh my goodness, how sublime. And, I follow the religion of the Gospels. But the vicar himself in the profession, but certainly Rousseau in his own name, when he writes about the Gospels and about being a Christian, effectively, it turns into the natural goodness of man in the end for Rousseau. So it's not a religion in any, you know, sort of recognizable Christian sense. And he revives it, and because he thinks we need a moral compass. His religion of the gospel does not include, say, Jesus, God, the Immaculate Conception. It doesn't include any of those miracles. It doesn't include any of those things. What it boils down to is the moral law, that we access through reason.
It's a form of Christianity that can be made compatible with the spirit of the age, as it were, right? With a kind of growing scientific view. I mean, this is why, I mean, it's, you know, Rousseau, I think, it seems you're right. I mean, he's aware of the tension between truth and utility that you've sketched already since the first discourse, and is not going to offer up to us something, you know, that might be edifying, but patently regarded as false by, you know, an enlightened age, right? So he needs a kind of rationalized religion, as it were, right? Mm-hmm. One question I had, you know, that I wanted to get in before we close is the one of the things that occurs to me in thinking about Rousseau and religion, especially in, and we've been talking about his kind of genealogical historical accounts of human beings. One of the things that Rousseau doesn't really examine is like the origin of religion in the human soul and where it comes from and our natural development. Something like, you know, Hume has this book called The Natural History of Religion. You know, Rousseau doesn't really have a natural history of religion, does he? And do you know why?
Well, there is a brief, before he introduces the profession of faith, there is a brief kind of natural history of religion there. But only very brief. And, you know, he imagines these primitive human beings, wondering, is there some sort of principle here? Is there some sort of order? What explains the disorders? So they're confronted by their natural environment, and fear is among the things that they experience, and they need to make up a story to explain, you know, how they got here, why things are the way they are. They start to develop, for example, metaphysical dualism in a very sort of anthropomorphic sense, like the vicar is about to do. So it's a very brief treatment. And I think it largely just, it comes out of our psychological needs, very much like, in that sense, very much like Hume. I would call Hume's natural history of religion to be rather uncharitable account of religion. Rousseau's is more charitable, I would put it. I think Hume might have thought lots of people needed religion for various reasons, but I think Rousseau really thinks people need religion. And the David Humes of the world are few and far between. If they actually don't need religion and can die peacefully, as Adam Smith recounts Hume's death.
Right. We need religion more than we need reason. Right. I mean, the thing, like in the second discourse, there's much more of a thematized account of how reason comes about from our kind of corrupt selfishness. I mean, you don't get an analogous kind of, well, religion comes about because of our corruption and, you know, so unlike Hume, where you might think, you know, well, the solution to these sorts of things is you need to develop a more rational, enlightened society. For Rousseau, you need more virtue and more religion, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there were actually in the second discourse, there are fragments of an earlier draft he took out that did deal with religion, but it really had to do with priestcraft, to use the term of the day, as another source of authority and inequality. So it wasn't a natural history, religion, psychological, anthropological type discussion, but rather what would have gone in the second part of the work of the second discourse about the development of government and so on and so forth on our way down to the nadir of the present.
And I just wanted to close by asking about, I guess, you know, is this a, Rousseau does have a kind of elitist, I guess, streak to his thinking in some of these ways. I'm thinking again about the first discourse where he you know, you sort of prescribe a certain kind of concern about the arts and sciences for the mass of human beings, but then there are these kind of geniuses or whatever who, you know, it's perfectly appropriate and indeed great that they engage in the arts and the sciences. I mean, is there a similar, I think, you know, view here, which is that, you know, religion is good for the masses, but, you know, for the few, maybe like Rousseau himself, maybe Emile, maybe others, I'm not sure, but, you know, it's unnecessary that you could turn to philosophy as a consolation. Is there, you know, the sort of mass and elite distinction in this thought?
Yeah, I think so. And that's where really coming down to the problem of truth and utility again is putting aside epistemological modesty about what we can actually know about what's true. It may be the things we learn about what's true are only accessible, first of all, to certain people, and only palatable for certain people. Let's say that the truths of natural science, like a Newton, show us, for the sake of argument, show us a world in which we don't matter. Well, we want to matter. We need to matter as individuals and as human beings in general. So it could be that the teachings of science undermine, and first of all, they're cosmopolitan, the teachings of science and or philosophy are cosmopolitan, whereas we live embedded in states or communities that have specific opinions, beliefs, et cetera, for Rousseau. So there's already between a cosmopolitan truth and a sort of localized utility attention for him as well. I'd close by saying that in answer to your question, Rousseau is really good at getting people to believe his persona. He's really good. One example is in the Confessions. I reviewed a biography of Rousseau some time ago, in which the author sort of hook, line, and sinker bought Rousseau's sort of proto-Freudian rhetoric without considering the possibility it's Rousseau who's writing this. He's not on the couch, you know, with his therapist. He's on, he's writing at his desk, and he's in control of the personae that he has. Well, I think the two personae that he has that get pretty undermined pretty quickly, one of them is that he's a Democrat egalitarian, but he's not. He believes there are, you know, a few geniuses, as you say, in the first discourse, and everyone else. He's not a simple egalitarian at any rate. And likewise, and more importantly, I think for my project here, this book, is his persona of being sincere and authentic. People say, well, how could a guy who admits that he was exposing himself in tunnels in Turin not be telling me the truth about what he believes about God? We'll put aside the exposure in Turin question and say, well, Rousseau has reasons for not being entirely sincere. And people have really bought the persona that he has. And just because one of the perverse things he does when he introduces the profession of faith as being a writing by someone else is he declares that he's doing so because of his motto of dedicating life to truth. So he's about to lie to you about this writing that he includes here, and he pronounces himself as being dedicated to truth. So it's a much more complicated story, I think, than simply Rousseau, the sincere, with hard on hand, Boy Scout kind of persona that he projects.
Well, John, thanks again for the conversation, and thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation, Jeff. Nice talking to you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.